Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. Last year, the world's oceans hit record temperatures. The last decade was the warmest on record. This is according to a new study published in the journal Advances of Atmospheric Science. The lead author of the study compared the current rate of ocean warming equivalent to 5 Hiroshima-sized atomic bombs exploding every second. If these conditions continue, experts expect the ocean to rise by 1 meter by the end of the century, which could displace up to 150 million people. One of the study's authors and one of today's guests, Professor John Abraham, says the climate crisis is getting worse, and this is just the tip of the iceberg for what's to come. So what are the consequences of all of this? And as we ask almost every day on this show, what can we do about this? Dr. John Abraham is professor of thermal sciences at the University of St. Thomas School of Engineering in St. Paul, Minnesota. His research includes climate monitoring and renewable energy generation for the developing world. His energy development work has extended to Africa, South America, and Asia. Hi, Dr. Abraham. Thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be on with you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. We're also joined by Dr. Becca Selden, Associate Professor of Biological Sciences at Wellesley College in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Her research focuses on how fishing and climate change are altering marine ecosystems. She's also investigating how social ecological systems respond to global change. Hi, Dr. Selden. Thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I want to ask you both a very general question, because I feel like every week we wake up to a new dire study about the climate crisis, and every Monday we focus on these issues. So we're really, we try to be on top of all of this. In September of last year, a UN report concluded that the world's oceans and ice sheets are under such severe stress that the fallout could prove difficult for humans to contain without very steep reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. Dr. Abraham, first off, can you tell us why the oceans are so critical in our understanding of the climate crisis?
Well, that's a really great question, and that was central to our study. The reason why the oceans are so important is the oceans are where the heat goes. So scientists have known for decades, actually for over 100 years, that the Earth is warming and that greenhouse gases cause warming. Look, we know that. That's been demonstrated conclusively. What we really want to know now is how fast is it warming and what are the consequences? And if you want to measure how fast the Earth is warming, you must measure the oceans, because more than 90% of global warming heat ends up in the oceans. So what we like to say is ocean warming is global warming. They are the critical reservoir for heat, and that's why they're so important.
Can you elaborate on that a bit? Just talk about, the oceans absorb, as you said, over 90% of greenhouse gases. Talk about how that works.
Yeah, sure. So as humans burn fossil fuels, we emit greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, and some of these gases we're familiar with. They're carbon dioxide, methane, water vapor, or humidity is a greenhouse gas as well. There's a bunch of greenhouse gases. The most important one that humans emit is carbon dioxide. And those greenhouse gases serve as an insulation layer around the Earth. And as we make that insulation layer thicker or more powerful, it means that we hold more heat down near the Earth. The Earth would like to be in what's called equilibrium. That means it would like to release the same amount of heat to space that it gains from the sun. And for the last many decades, we have been releasing less heat to space than we've been gaining by the sun. So there's an imbalance. It's sort of like your bank account. If you're getting a little more money each week than you're spending, your bank account or the amount of money in your bank account is going to grow, and we call that an imbalance. That's a good imbalance. Well, the Earth is in a bad imbalance. Every year, the amount of heat in the Earth is growing because of this insulation layer that's getting thicker. And that heat ends up in the oceans, and we know that from our own everyday experience, which can explain it. If you put a pot of water on the stove and turn on the flame, it takes a long time for that water to heat up because water is great at storing heat. Mm. The air is not so great. So so it turns out almost all of this extra heat from this insulation layer ends up in the oceans, and we want to measure it, and we want to know what the impacts are to society and biological systems around the world.
And as you write in The Guardian, you write regular pieces for The Guardian, if you want to measure global warming, you really have to measure ocean warming.
That's exactly right, and that's what we tried to do in this paper.
Dr. Selden, what would you add to when we talk about, you know, why oceans are so critical in our understanding of the climate crisis?
Yeah, I think that for many of us, it's an ecosystem that we maybe live near. Many of us like to eat seafood, and so and most of the seafood that we get is coming from, you know, wild capture fisheries, and so when we think about what we're doing to the oceans when they're absorbing all that extra heat, we're actually, you know, making it harder for us to get that seafood from the ocean. And that's a problem for some nations where that seafood is the primary source of protein for many coastal nations. And so it can become an equity issue. It obviously is causing these big effects on coral reefs and other ecosystems that are really iconic. And so I think it just has ripple effects across our whole society and our globe.
When this study came out, it got international headlines. You know, a lot of the headlines said, last year the world's oceans hit record temperatures. Dr. Selden, was this surprising in the scientific community, or was this expected?
I guess I have to say it was unfortunately probably expected. I mean, I think we've done a lot of modeling over the last, you know, 30 years that have given us some pretty good projections of what we're expecting when we add this extra insulating layer to the atmosphere, like Dr. Abraham had said. And our models are actually matching the observations pretty well, which suggests that it really is this extra carbon emissions that is driving this warming. And so I think we're not surprised, but I think we're getting a better and better understanding of what impact that has on the ocean ecosystems. And I think we're at this critical crossroads where we can take action now to sort of slow this process and avoid the outcome that we have a warming of more than 2 degrees Celsius. But that possibility becomes more and more remote the longer that we wait.
Let's talk a little bit about how you actually measure the temperature of the oceans. Dr. Abraham, in one of your Guardian pieces, you pointed out that the leader of your team, Dr. Li Zheng Chang, developed an innovative way to measure ocean temperatures. You write, we only get data where we place temperature sensors, and sophisticated mathematics are used to fill in the gaps and create a continuous picture of what is happening. So tell us more about how you actually measure the temperature of oceans.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. So measuring the oceans is really tough because the oceans are vast. They cover about 70% of our planet. And not only are they vast, they're deep. And so what we're discovering is that heat that comes in at the surface of the oceans is penetrating deeper and deeper into the ocean depths. And so if you want to measure ocean heating, you actually have to measure all over the globe, and you have to measure very, very deep into the oceans, at least 2,000 meters, or like 6,000 to 7,000 feet. Now, in the past, we've relied on instruments, temperature sensors that were dropped from ships, especially ships that would carry cargo, and they would drop these temperature sensors, record the temperature, send it to scientists, and then every year we would get a better and better picture of what was happening to the ocean warming. The problem with that method was most of our measurements were along shipping routes, especially in the northern hemisphere, so part of the southern hemisphere wasn't measured very well. And so our picture was a bit foggy. But around 2005, there was an international effort to put better temperature sensors in the ocean, and they were deployed in 2005, and they're called the Argo floats. And they are around 3,800 temperature sensors spread out around the ocean, and they're pretty sophisticated. They rise and fall in the ocean waters over time, and as they rise and fall through the ocean, they gather temperature data. And then when they finally make it to the surface, they beam that temperature data to satellites, which then ends up at research centers. So as of 2005, the Argo system is sort of the gold standard of measuring temperatures. But even with the Argo system, you only know the temperatures where they're measured. And so one of the questions we had is, how can we get a picture of what's happening between the sensors? And Li-Jing Cheng, my colleague, came up with a very clever and very accurate way to fill in the gaps. And that has allowed us to reduce our uncertainty about how fast the ocean is warming. I mean, we knew it was warming, but this helps us put a finer point on it. And so we have a really compelling picture, especially over the last 5 years, but frankly, all the way back to the 1960s, that the oceans are warming. And just to put an addendum to what my colleague said, this isn't just by chance. I mean, it's not as though 2019 was the hottest year just by coincidence. In fact, the last 5 years are the five hottest years ever recorded by humans.
Wow.
And the only explanation that we have is human-caused greenhouse gas emissions. Mm. So the pieces of this puzzle are fitting together very nicely from a scientific standpoint.
Is the rise in ocean temperatures uniform, or is it hotter in certain areas?
Boy, that's a really, really good question, and it is not uniform. It is certainly hotter in some areas. And just to provide some perspective, if you are off the east coast of the United States and up to the east coast of Canada, it's warmed more than average. If you're off of the coast between Brazil and Africa, it's warmed a lot. Parts of the Indian Ocean have warmed a lot. But by the Philippines and south of Japan, it hasn't warmed that much at all. So it does depend on where you live, but the vast majority of the Earth's oceans have warmed. And one of the consequences of that, aside from just the impacts of sea creatures, is that it causes the oceans to rise. As water heats up, it expands. And that contributes significantly to how fast the ocean levels are rising. And in your lead-in, you mentioned about a meter of sea level rise by 2100. That's a little over 3 feet. That's a big deal.
Mm.
That's a big deal for society. I mean, if you know people in Miami right now, parts of Miami are starting to flood at high tide.
Yeah.
And this is going to get worse, and it's going to be really, really, really expensive. And one of the things that scientists have been saying for decades is, the quicker we take action, the less costly it will be. The longer we wait, the more costly it will be. And that's a story that's true today.
And what's amazing about that, Dr. Abraham, is the year 2100 sounds so futuristic, but it's 80 years away. So the babies that are being born right now will be 80 when this is happening.
Yeah, that is exactly right. And I also don't want people to think that the impacts are not going to happen until 2100. They're actually already happening.
Right.
The warming oceans are making storms more severe. They are making rainfall from hurricanes more severe. They made Superstorm Sandy more severe. The weather is becoming supercharged. We like to say it's weather on steroids. So as a result, what we're seeing is bigger swings in weather. So you can go from hot and dry to really wet to hot and dry again. And folks out in California have experienced that, right? I mean, out in California, you've had a drought, which is now over, but it was the worst drought in over 1,000 years. And that's the kind of weather whiplash that we're experiencing, and it will only get worse. So we don't have to wait for 2100 for the consequences to appear. They're already appearing, but they're going to get worse.
This is such an important point, Professor Selden. There was a recent piece on Al Jazeera English, and it was about how people are realizing that Miami is in big trouble. And so you are actually having developers go to a higher level of Miami where a lot of Haitians live. It's basically called Little Haiti. And they're trying to buy up that land to develop, because they're now planning for what's to come with sea level rise. And I mean, I want to do a separate show about this, but a lot of Haitians in Miami are fighting back. You know, it's a fairly poor area. And they say, look, we worked for this. We developed this community. We're not going to allow it to gentrify. So this is happening right now.
Absolutely. I mean, I think my work with fisheries also suggests that this is a problem for right now. I think fisheries are really on the front line of these impacts. We've seen extreme warming events on the West Coast, the Pacific warm blob that occurred between 2013 and 2016, that had a very, very large patch of water that was significantly warmer than usual, 2 to 7 degrees Fahrenheit higher than usual, from Alaska down to Baja California. That is a huge amount of ocean, and that's had huge effects on starvation of seabirds, strandings of sea lions, low returns of coastal salmon. We had fisheries disasters totaling more than $70 million because of this event. And so I do want to very much emphasize that this is an issue that is having impacts now, and I think those economic impacts and those social impacts, I think, in some way may motivate us to take this seriously, to take action now, because it's only going to get worse if we have inaction.
And if I could just add to that,
sure.
I mean, one of the things that makes, I mean, look, there, this is dire. The climate change issue is dire, and the fact that we've done nothing on it for decades is dire, and the fact that we have an administration who claims it's a fraud perpetrated by Chinese scientists, that's also dire. So there's a lot of dire news, but there's also reason for hope. And the reason for hope is that the cost of clean energy has dropped so dramatically that right now, wind and solar power, for instance, can compete head-to-head on economic terms with, for example, coal. So in the past, people would invest in wind and solar as a bit of altruism. They wanted to be better stewards of the environment. But now you can be a good steward of the environment and be a good steward of your finances. So there were many people who tended to be more conservative, who would say, well, it's too expensive to do anything about it. And that argument no longer holds. And so the economic pieces of the puzzle are in place for us to rapidly and massively make a shift to clean, renewable energy. And that's one of the areas that gives me a lot of hope.
Dr. John Abraham is professor of thermal sciences at the University of St. Thomas School of Engineering in St. Paul, Minnesota. His research includes climate monitoring and renewable energy generation for the developing world. His energy development work has extended to Africa, South America, and Asia. He writes about these issues in The Guardian. Dr. Becca Selden is associate professor of biological sciences at Wesley College in Massachusetts. Her research focuses on how fishing and climate change are altering marine ecosystems. And today we are talking about what is happening to our oceans. Last year, the oceans hit record temperatures. The last decade was the warmest on record, according to a new study published in the journal Advances in Atmospheric Science. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you have any questions or comments about the warming oceans, what are the consequences? What can we do about this? You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet at yourcallradio. Let's hear from Phil in New Mexico. Hi, Phil. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for taking my call. Two data points and a couple of questions. One is I heard a discussion by a professor at University of North Carolina who pointed out that the slope of the land in the Carolinas, Florida, and the Gulf Coast is 1 to 10,000. So if there is a 1 meter sea level rise, that means 30 kilometers of land will be submerged from the current coastline. So that's a sobering thought. Second thing is, Bloomberg had an article last week about this new development that seems to be sweeping through the world of computer modelers, the climate modelers, and their models are suddenly predicting instead of 3 degrees by 2100, they're showing up at like 4.3 and so on. I wanted to ask the professors about that. And then lastly, can they talk about what is the carbon capture contribution of healthy coral reefs and undersea kelp forests versus the dead coral reefs and dying kelp forests?
All right, thank you for that one. Why don't we talk about the coral reefs and the kelp forests first? Because we did a show about a month or so ago about the alarming decline in kelp forests and the explosion of kelp-eating purple sea urchins off of California's coast. I mean, these numbers are just really shocking. Between 2013 and 2017, 90% of bull kelp and 96% of red abalone disappeared from California's coasts. Dr. Selden, do you want to take that one first?
Sure, yes. I think we are having a much better understanding of the role of these important ecosystems as in blue carbon, say, in their capacity for carbon sequestration. And so kelp forests grow really fast, and so they can take in a lot of carbon during that process. They also are reasonably short-lived, so they can get uprooted in a storm, and then that can be transported down to deep water. And so all of that can sort of contribute to this carbon cycle. Some of the other ecosystems you mentioned, say mangroves or coral reefs, intact ecosystems provide more of that service than if they're destroyed, and I think we're getting a better understanding of the impacts of how warming would affect the ability of those ecosystems to deliver that service. So I think that's a great question, and I think it's an active area of research that I think we can use to understand how our ecosystems are going to change.
Dr. Abraham, what would you add?
Well, I'm going to defer to my colleague on kelp and the issues of carbon capture, but I can take the question on climate models.
Okay.
So climate models are computer calculations that we use as a tool to predict what's going to happen in the future. I mean, scientists love to run experiments, and we would love to have another Earth, maybe on the other side of the sun, that we could pollute with greenhouse gases just to see what would happen, but we don't. And while observations, measurements, can tell us what happened in the past, we need something to tell us what's happening in the future, and we rely on computer models. Now, our understanding of the Earth's climate is not based on computer models. We would know the Earth is warming, and we would know why, even if computers did not exist. But computer models are helpful for predicting how bad things will be in the future. And it turns out, computer models are predicting that temperature rises maybe quite a bit more than we thought, maybe 50% more.
Wow.
That's a big deal. That is a really, really big deal. I mean, the temperature difference between today and an ice sheet time period is just a few degrees Celsius. So changes in the Earth's temperature projections of a degree or two matter a lot. I mean, they're going to have tremendous impacts to human society, our economies, and biological systems.
Wow. I'd like to also add that one of the things that is totally unprecedented about the current warming relative to the other changes we've seen over sort of the history of our planet is that rate of change, that we have not seen this rate of warming before, and that's partly why we are seeing such severe impacts that we have. You can imagine over a long, thousands of years warming, perhaps animals and plants could evolve to adapt to the new temperatures, but we're just basically hitting the accelerate button, and that's what's making it so challenging for the ecosystems to adapt.
Yeah, that is exactly right. And so, I mean, we're trying to project what's going to happen in the future and what the impacts are going to be. It's really, really challenging. With respect to the computer models, we don't know why they're projecting higher temperatures. I hope they're not right, but computer models have been correct so many times in the past that it behooves us to pay attention to them. I mean, I'm hoping they're not right. If they are right and we're going to warm more than we thought, it's going to be really, really challenging. But it just strikes how important it is to make actions right now. I mean, to reduce our use of fossil fuels and to increase our reliance on clean, renewable energy. We are the ones in control. And as long as we're in control, we can do something about it. But the longer we delay, the more costly it's going to be to animals and the environment and humans.
Well, thank you for the call, Phil. After the break, we'll spend some more time talking about coral reefs. Dr. John Abraham is professor of thermal sciences at the University of St. Thomas School of Engineering in St. Paul, Minnesota. Dr. Becca Selden is associate professor of biological sciences at Wellesley College in Massachusetts. It's our One Planet series today, and we are talking about the world's oceans. They hit record temperatures last year, and the last decade was the warmest on record. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call's One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will speak with Andrea Bernstein, author of American Oligarchs, The Kushners, The Trumps, and The Marriage of Money and Power. And then on Wednesday, we will be talking about the results in New Hampshire and what's to come. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us an email, yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's show about warming oceans, what are the consequences? What can we do about this? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet at Your Call Radio. Today we're joined by Dr. John Abraham, Professor of Thermal Sciences at the University of St. Thomas School of Engineering in St. Paul, Minnesota. Dr. Becca Selden is Associate Professor of Biological Sciences at Wellesley College in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Can we spend a little bit more time talking about coral reefs? We've done a lot of shows about what happens when the water is too warm and then the corals bleach, turning white. And if you have not seen the documentary Chasing Coral, they do really an amazing job of explaining what happens, and they actually see the coral turn white almost in real time. In Australia, they saw this happened to the Great Barrier Reef. So a 2016 study estimates that 98% of coral reefs worldwide will experience bleaching level stress every year by 2050. Dr. Selden, I mean, this is really dire. Can you just talk about what warming oceans mean to the coral reefs? We're already seeing this happen.
Yeah, I think the magnitude of this problem was shown in the warming events that were back-to-back in the Great Barrier Reef that has left so much of that area bleached. And it's really a single warming event, a single bleaching event corals can come back from. They basically, the bleaching happens because they eject the zooxanthellae, which provide one of the food sources for the coral. And over time, they can get the zooxanthellae back. A new set they can bring in. But it's really the back-to-back events that are causing this huge decline in coral cover in the Great Barrier Reef. So I think the study you just mentioned that suggests that 98% of the coral is going to be suffering some sort of bleaching stress every year is such a concerning statistic. I think but I do want to, I guess, give a little glimmer of hope is that some of that is thinking just about coral sort of staying in place. But we actually do see some evidence that coral reefs are sort of moving poleward to stay in some of the temperatures that they might have been adapted to. So, for example, coral reefs are replacing macroalgae in parts of Japan. There's some suggestion that it's moving poleward in Australia. Animals are quite adaptable, and sort of if there's habitat for them to move to, they can move poleward. We find that shifting distributions is one of the major ways that species have been dealing with the warming oceans thus far. So that might be a little bit of a glimmer of hope, though I think what we can do is actually to take action locally. So, climate change is the global stressor, but we can do things like put in marine protected areas that can reduce fishing pressure on, say, herbivores that keep macroalgae from overgrowing coral. And by that way, we can actually increase resilience so that when there is a bleaching event, macroalgae can't take over. So I think it all comes together in that way, and we can take more local action, and that's, I think, a positive step.
And you have been out in the field measuring ocean temperatures, specifically in one of your studies, showing how it's affecting the migration of black sea bass on the eastern seaboard. What did you find there?
Yeah, we actually found black sea bass is one of the species that is moving as rapidly as any other species that we see on the Atlantic seaboard. We see that it's actually moving north into the Gulf of Maine. So this is a warm water species that is typically found off of North Carolina, Virginia, getting up into New Jersey, but hadn't really been found north of Cape Cod until the 2012 warming event that occurred there. And this is particularly concerning because black sea bass eat juvenile lobster. As you know, lobster is one of the main fisheries for the state of Maine, and so there's a lot of concern if black sea bass are coming into that area that it may have a negative impact on the boom in lobster fisheries that we've actually seen, potentially because the warming has actually made it a little bit better for lobster in those cold waters in the Gulf of Maine. So again, I mean, this also highlights that warming is not uniformly bad for all species. There are some species that like warm water. There are some species that like cold water. And so if we look at what happens in a particular place, warming oceans are going to create winners and losers, and sort of who we see in a particular spot is likely to change. And that's important to think about in terms of how we design our conservation and our management. What is the role of marine protected areas if it's now covering a new mix of species than what it was originally established for? A naysayer might say, well, why do we have marine protected areas at all? But for me, it's still providing that that important protection from fishing for whatever species it protects within its borders, and that makes it important still. But I think we just need to have our eyes open to what changes are likely to come with the warming oceans and make sure our conservation and management strategies are robust or able to deal with those changes.
We've done a few shows also about the changes with lobsters. And last June, the Washington Post had a lengthy investigative piece. There's no doubt things are changing. The Gulf of Maine is warming faster than 99% of the world's oceans, dramatically disrupting fishery patterns and creating new winners and losers. So, Dr. Selden, I mean, there's so much that's changing from here to the East Coast. And you talked about resiliency. I mean, what does the data tell us about the resiliency of, I mean, I guess it's you have to look at individual animals and species because you know that there's resiliency with the reefs. But what happens when lobsters move north?
Yeah, I mean, I think one way forward, I think, is actually to maybe focus less on species identity, but rather sort of the function of that species in the ecosystem. So my own research showed that cod is likely to decline in the Gulf of Maine as water is warm, and so its importance as a predator in that ecosystem is likely to decline. Mm. But our model suggests that warm water predators like spiny dogfish are going to gain in habitat, and that could potentially protect the ecosystem against the ripple effects of losing cod. And so I think a way forward in thinking about what do these novel ecosystems mean for the biology, for the people, is to start thinking about the actual species traits and thinking about, you know, when we have this sort of warming, shuffling the deck on what species we see in different places, the outcomes aren't inherently bad. We just need to reexamine sort of our paradigms of conservation. You know, what is the species doing in this ecosystem? Can fishers change to a new species? You know, obviously, lobster, that would be a very hard sell. Lobster is very, very valuable, and so shifting to something else would be a dramatic shift, not only in how they fish, but, you know, all of the markets, the all of the communities in Maine. I don't want to minimize that, but I think it also, we need to think more broadly about what warming is going to do to the ecosystems and what those novel ecosystems mean.
Dr. Abraham, what are your thoughts?
Well, I would just like to echo what my colleague said and point out that all of this shows we're all connected. Mm-hmm. We are connected and rely upon the ecosystem of the ocean and the ocean waters. And what happens there will affect us. I'm in Minnesota. I'm at an elevation of about 800 feet. Rising sea levels is not going to cover my house or my place of business. And I don't eat lobster that much. So people might say, well, shoot, you're insulated from this process. But I'm not, because the economics are connected around the world. If we have to relocate Miami, that's going to cost everyone. It's going to cost me living in Minnesota as well as people living in Florida. When Superstorm Sandy came in, and I think it cost something like $60 or $70 billion, a sizable part of that cost was because of climate change. That cost me as well as people out in New York. So if you have friends or colleagues who think that they might be insulated from the impacts of climate change, or if they think that climate change is only affecting polar bears and colorful fish in the tropics, they're wrong. Climate change is affecting all of us. It's affecting animals, plants, and our pocketbooks. Last year, we had incredibly wet weather in the center part of the United States, which impacted farming. You know, you might think if you're living in Iowa, you might be isolated from climate change. Not at all. Everyone's going to be affected. Everyone is being affected. And the longer we go without doing something about it, the worse it's going to be for all of us. And I think that's an important takeaway message that should motivate us. And it should motivate us to do the right thing, which, as I mentioned before, is to reduce our use of energy. Just use energy more wisely. I mean, let's not waste what we've got. And also to maximize our use of clean and renewable energy. I mean, we can create jobs in the United States, save money at homes and in our businesses, and help solve the climate problem. And who can be against that?
Let's go to another caller. Let's hear from Rich and Ben Lomond. Hi, Rich. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I'd like to mention this system called the HARP system. I think it's High Altitude Auroral Research Project. I've heard people like David, I think his name is David Keith, talking about controlling the weather, and I think that that is another a factor to consider. And now, I, as far as carbon dioxide goes, the argument, one of the arguments is, well, carbon dioxide doesn't hurt anything because it's good for the plants, and they'll give us more food. Well, that may or not, it may not be true. In other words, carbon dioxide generated in a city might not help anybody who's thousands of miles away. And at the same time, let me give you this example. What's the difference, for example, between carbon dioxide in the atmosphere from a volcano versus carbon dioxide in the atmosphere caused by burning fossil fuel? And the answer is fossil fuel uses up oxygen. And as such, I think the critical issue, the critical gas here is oxygen. And as a person who has had a lifetime dealing with machinery, I can tell you that there are far more efficient ways of burning fossil fuel to get energy than what we have now. And to decrease the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, you could easily modify the equipment that we have, these internal combustion engines. No one has really mentioned that.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in. Do either of you, are either of you familiar with what Rich is talking about?
I'll jump in here. I'm not familiar with it, but I can tell you that there's a lot of discussion on what's called geoengineering, and that is to make modifications to our atmosphere to affect weather and climate. So, for example, we know that volcanic eruptions have the potential to cool the planet. Some volcanoes can erupt and cool the planet for about 3 years. And the way they do this is they eject little particles up into the upper part of the atmosphere that reflects sunlight. And those particles stay up in the upper part of the atmosphere for about 3 years, so the effect lasts. Well, it turns out humans could do that ourselves. We could make synthetic volcanoes, and we could lower the temperature a bit. I am not in favor of that at all, because that's emitting one pollution to stop the effect of the other pollution. And in fact, if you start doing geoengineering, not only do you not know the consequences of it, some unintended consequences, but now you've got to keep doing it forever. And so in my mind, and in fact in almost every one of my colleagues' minds, the best thing to do is to reduce emissions. And the way to reduce emissions is to use our energy more wisely and to use more green, clean energy. And we can do that today with today's technology. I mean, let's think about a gallon of gas. No one is making gas today. Gas was made by microbes that digested materials over millions of years. So a gallon of gas is really, really precious. No one's making it, and it's got a finite, there's a finite amount of it, and it's got a lot of energy. A gallon of gas can take an SUV, push it 60 miles an hour for 20 miles. That's a lot of energy. I mean, that would be a lot of cheeseburgers I'd have to eat to have that kind of energy. So if gas is so precious, let's use it more wisely. Yeah, let's use it sparingly. Let's not waste it as we've been wasting it over the past decades. And whether it's the internal combustion engine or whether it's making our homes and energy, our homes and commercial buildings more efficient, there are ways we can reduce our use of energy. People in California right now are producing about one quarter of the greenhouse gases of someone in Wyoming. Mm. So it can be done. We can reduce our emissions. We've got to do it now. We've got to act quickly. And the quicker we act, the better.
Well, so let's talk about this, because when we do shows about this, about plastic, you name it, the guests say the oil and gas industry realize that there's so much money at stake here. I mean, we're talking about billions, if not trillions of dollars, and they are not going to go down without a fight. In fact, we did a really interesting show about plastic and how the plastics industry is, you know, pressuring states, and they're doing it very successfully because they give mostly Republicans a lot of, well, not that much, but some campaign contributions. And they're even doing like bans on bans. So there's a ban on plastic bag bans in some states. I mean, they're going to fight this until the end. So I'd love you both to talk about how you see this playing out. I mean, obviously the 2020 election is very, very important because you have, you know, the Trump administration basically saying, sure, let's open the Arctic to oil and gas drilling. At the same time, you have massive activism happening with youth, indigenous activism. So, Dr. Selden, how do you see this playing out in the next year, for example?
Yeah, I'm encouraged by the youth activism that I've seen, including on my own campus of Wellesley College. I think it really is the challenge of this generation, and I think if politicians start paying attention to that constituency, I think we could have some action. I think there's an intergenerational ethics issue that, you know, we're creating a problem for our children and our children's children. And so I think the more that we see these vocal voices of the youth, I think how can you make that choice that's going to disadvantage your children? And I think it's just becoming really stark, and I'm hoping that we can leverage that momentum to put some actions into place. So I'm hopeful.
Dr. Abraham?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, on the one hand, where we are at is really demoralizing, because if you were to talk to me 3 years ago, the United States was a world leader on climate. We had had what's called the Clean Power Plan in the United States, which was a major plan to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And in fact, the industry was on board with that, because what industry really wants is clear guidelines. They want to be able to plan for the future. And if we can set some guidelines in place, they'll work hard to meet those guidelines. But that plan was in place. That was a fantastic plan. We had great agreements with China. China was doing incredible work to reduce their own emissions. We had agreements with countries in Europe and also India. So the U.S. was a leader just 3 years ago, and now the U.S. has become a pariah. We're the one country to have backed out of the Paris Climate Accord, which is our best chance at reducing global warming. So things can change from one extreme to another very, very quickly. So sure, the election of this year is going to matter a lot. But even if the current administration stays in office, what we're seeing is other countries have decided to take leadership roles. In the past, countries would wait until the U.S. acted, and then they would follow suit. But now, countries realize that they can't wait anymore. They have to take action, and we're finding other countries step into these leadership roles, which is actually a good thing, because, frankly, the United States, for the last 3 or 4 decades, has worked to stop efforts on climate change. And with other countries stepping into the leadership positions, hopefully that will change.
We have a related question from Sandy, who says, your guests say it can be done structurally. How can it be done?
Well, and I would go back to the answer I just gave. The 3 years ago, we were doing it. 3 years ago, we had plans both in the United States, but also international agreements and the Paris Accord to dramatically reduce greenhouse gases. And what your listeners should know is that was done with current technology. I mean, we know how to reduce emissions. We know how to slow the rise of temperatures. We know how to do it. We don't need to wait for cold fusion. We don't need to wait for unicorns and pixie dust to give us some magical source of energy. We can do it today with today's technology. What we need is leadership in Washington to take that action seriously and to enact rules and regulations. Now, if the United States federal government is not going to do it, then states can do it. And in fact, you're already seeing that with states, especially California's. California is one of the leading states on this, making their own rules that affect how energy is produced and used in their states. So we can do it. We were doing it 3 years ago. We can go back to doing it very quickly. But elections do matter.
What are some of the tangible policy changes you both would like to see?
I would like to see a dividend a tax on carbon with a dividend system. So that means that anything that was carbon intensive had a tax, And that money went into a pool, and every citizen of the United States would get a check every year to cover their costs. Now, what that would do is it would encourage people to purchase goods and services that would produce less greenhouse gases. And that would create an economic incentive to develop technologies that used energy more wisely and used clean, renewable energy. So I think a dividend system like that, which is revenue neutral, would reward people for making good decisions because you would end up with money in your pocket at the end of the year. That's what I would like to see.
Dr. Selden, what would you like to see?
Well, there actually was a new initiative that was put on the floor, I think of the House, called the Climate Ready Fisheries Act. And I think those sorts of proactive looking measures where we're really sort of acknowledging that we are going to see some effect of climate change in the near term, no matter what we do with emissions, is a good step in the right direction so that we can actually sort of design our management to be able to deal with whatever changes are going to come down the pipeline.
And we have a tweet from Jennifer who says, if people are hearing this and feeling powerless, there are many things we can do. What I've witnessed as an environmental activist since the 80s, one of the most powerful is divesting from fossil fuels. And Jennifer links to a website, I'm not sure if I'm saying this right, but it's Mazaska Talks, meaning money talks. And this umbrella organization sprung from the indigenous-led Seattle divestment campaign in January 2017. And so there's a lot of information here about pipelines, about divesting. If you have a financial relationship with one of the big banks that provides money to oil and gas companies, find an alternative. We've done a lot of shows about alternative banks and funds. It's always really important to just check that out. There's also a list of some of the banks that are giving the most to fossil fuel companies. According to Rainforest Action, you've got JP Morgan Chase at the very top with Citibank in second. On a side note, Dr. Abraham, here in San Francisco, we have a brand new stadium. And who got the naming rights to that? Chase, which I think is very, I don't even know what the word is. San Francisco bills itself as one of the greenest cities in the country, and yet they gave naming rights to Chase Bank for this brand new stadium.
Well, and money still talks around the country and around the world. But as we said before, and as one of the tweeters mentioned, there is an area for optimism. And that is we can take action now, both at the state level, the city level, and national and internationally. We can do it. We have done it. And we can make meaningful action. And if we make good decisions now, we're not only going to solve the environmental problem, but we're going to save money and diversify our economy and participate in the green energy economy of the future. I mean, I do energy work around the world, and I'll tell you, the only person who's selling solar panels in many countries is China or Chinese companies. I would love to export our green technologies to other countries and generate jobs in the United States. And we're missing a golden opportunity, but there's a reason to be optimistic, and we can do it. As long as voters value the environment and recognize the costs that we're going to incur by not doing anything, elected officials will take action. Now, we haven't hit a critical mass yet. I mean, climate has not been a voting issue that has been sufficient enough that people of both parties, and let's be honest, the Republican Party has had a litmus test of climate change denial. Let's be honest about that. But if Republican voters decide to take action and value the environment, their elected officials will follow suit immediately. Let's not underestimate the power of the vote.
What else are you seeing, Dr. Abraham, since you do so much work overseas? What else are you seeing overseas that you would like to be emulated here, or that does give you some hope?
One of the technologies that has been emerging for a while is called microgrids, where energy is generated locally and used locally. And we are using microgrid technology in East Africa with great success. And that, I think, is the future of energy production here in the United States, especially as people put up wind power and solar power, either at their own homes or in cooperatives. the ability to generate and use energy locally with smart grids will have a major effect on the amount of greenhouse gases we emit, but also on the cost of our electricity. So I'm really encouraged by that, and that's something we're seeing internationally, but also in the United States.
What about you, Dr. Selden? Is there anything you're seeing that gives you hope that we should know about?
Yeah, I want to highlight some of the collaborative work that is happening in the Gulf of Maine. Researchers from the University of Maine have partnered with lobster fishermen to actually put temperature data loggers on their traps to get more real-time estimates of what the conditions are where the lobster are, that to actually give them sort of an early warning system of what effects there might be on the lobster population. And I think those sorts of efforts, if done, you know, more broadly, I think could really give us more data to help anticipate the changes that are going to come and hopefully mitigate them.
Dr. Becca Selden is Associate Professor of Biological Sciences at Wesley College in Wesley, Massachusetts. Her research focuses on how fishing and climate change are altering marine ecosystems. Dr. Selden, thank you for your work and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. John Abraham is Professor of Thermal Sciences at the University of St. Thomas School of Engineering in St. Paul, Minnesota, where he researches climate monitoring and renewable energy generation for the developing world. Dr. Abraham, thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure to be on.
Dr. Abraham also writes a lot about the climate crisis for The Guardian. You can find his articles at yourcallradio.org. And I feel like, you know, every time we talk about these issues, when we're saying that last year, the world's oceans hit record temperatures. I was just reading the website this morning, ExxonNew.org. Exxon knew about climate change half a century ago. They deceived the public, misled their shareholders, and robbed humanity of a generation's worth of time to reverse climate change. So it's always important to look at how we got here in addition to looking at how we are going to get out. You can find more information about the show at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Jonathan Linden for answering the phones today and Joanne Marr, our studio engineer. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.